This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
We're going to win so big. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to win so big. Thank you.
That's Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump speaking at the opening of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland last night. We'll have all of the highlights and the latest developments coming up. Also, South Africa is the epicenter of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, with nearly 7 million people living with the disease. The International AIDS Conference is taking place this week in Durban. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the U.S. Republican Party opened their national convention in chaotic fashion yesterday. The day was marked with protests outside the convention hall and delegate upheaval inside, mostly directed at their nominee-in-waiting, Donald Trump. Mr. Trump and his wife, Melania, both spoke on the opening night in hopes of uniting the party against Democrat Hillary Clinton. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Cleveland.
Donald Trump broke with tradition to speak on the opening night of the Republican convention, eager to hear from the nominee-to-be.
We're going to win so big. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to win so big. Thank you.
Trump took to the stage to introduce his wife, Melania.
It is my great honor to present the next First Lady of the United States, my wife, an amazing mother, an incredible woman, Melania Trump.
If you want someone to fight for you and your country, I can assure you, he's the guy. He will never, ever give up. And most importantly, he will never, ever let you down.
Earlier in the day, the convention opened in a businesslike manner.
This convention will come to order.
But the convention hall later slipped into chaos when Republican Party leaders blocked a last-ditch effort by anti-Trump forces to derail his nomination. It was an emotional battle that played out on the convention floor.
Those in favor of the rules package will say aye. Those opposed shall say no. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
No Trump! No KKK! No racist USA!
Outside the convention hall, protesters took to the streets of Cleveland for a variety of causes, though most were targeting Trump and his controversial rhetoric. The protesters were met by a heavy security presence on land, on water, and in the air. The four-day convention concludes with Trump's acceptance speech on Thursday. But even those who support Trump say they are most concerned with stopping his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton.
I do not know him well enough to say that I am unquestionably in his support. But the alternative doesn't exist, and so I'm happy to support him.
For her part, Clinton gave a speech of her own in Ohio to the NAACP convention in Cincinnati.
We all know about that other convention happening up in Cleveland today. My opponent in this race may have a different view, but there's nowhere I'd rather be than right here with all of you.
In Cleveland, more speeches and protests are expected on Tuesday. Jim Malone, VOA News, at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
Thank you, Jim. Well, today marks day two of the Republican National Convention. The focus will be on the U.S. economy with the theme, Make America Work Again. This, a day after Melania Trump told a primetime audience that her husband Donald is an amazing leader and the only one who can deliver change for the United States. Today's speakers include some of the party's most prominent figures, including House Speaker Paul Ryan and former presidential candidates Chris Christie and Ben Carson. In addition, two of Donald Trump's children will also speak. My colleague Vincent McCorry is at the convention in Cleveland. He spoke with me about some of the controversial highlights from last night. He also gave a look at what's ahead for this evening's session.
Yes, Kim, I think the convention lived up to its expectation, given the lineup of speakers that evening. You know, very significantly, if you listen to the former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, he spoke at length about how this country is threatened by Islamist extremists and how, from his perspective, the government of President Barack Obama has failed to secure this country. Of course, he went on to attack Hillary Clinton for having failed in Libya, and therefore, according to them, this is a strong case for Mr. Trump, that he is a strong person who can be relied upon to secure this country, both within the borders of the United States, but also outside. And then we know there was also the speech by Pat Smith of the Benghazi victim, Sean Smith, and two U.S. Marine Corps veterans who fought in the Battle of Benghazi, Mac Geist and another former Marine, John Tiergin. All of this were focusing squarely on the failings of the current administration to secure the United States. With all these killings and shootings across the country, but also abroad, they came out strongly to say that President Obama has been leading from behind instead of leading from the front, as the United States is expected to do.
In Pat Smith's speech, she really did not hold anything back. She gave a very emotional speech, and she personally blamed Hillary Clinton for the death of her son. What has been reaction to this?
For example, Pat Smith saying, "My son died because of Hillary Clinton's failing. I attribute the death of my son to Hillary." So they wanted to make it very personal. And this way, you know, you could see the people on the floor reacting to that. This is from one woman to another saying, "I don't have a son because of you, Miss Hillary Clinton."
One of the big stories that is coming out of the convention last night is the controversy over Mrs. Trump's, Melania Trump's, speech. Apparently, there are striking similarities in some of her passages that Michelle Obama used at the Democratic National Convention in 2008. So what is the atmosphere now regarding this controversy, and do you think this controversy is going to die down anytime soon?
It will die down with time, obviously, as the day advances and, of course, other speeches come up. But at the moment, this is the talk of town, that actually she lifted that whole line from Michelle Obama's speech, almost word for word. And as you've seen, they play them side by side. This is making people wonder how many other things perhaps could have been plagiarized. In fact, I was reading elsewhere where they've written that perhaps the line about her having gone to college and graduated with a degree in design and architecture, it's not entirely true that she actually went to college but dropped out in her first year. And she came to America and got married to Mr. Trump. She somehow decided to include this in her story that she went to college and graduated with a degree. So there's a lot of scrutiny over her sincerity and honesty. For some, they're looking at that speech and wondering whether did she write it or were there speech writers in the campaign who did it? And if so, how did somebody make that kind of a mistake? And what does that say about the campaign of Mr. Trump? But looking at the overall speech, she did a fabulous job, you can say, and they tried to a large extent to humanize Mr. Trump and project him as a person who is reliable, who keeps his word, keeps his promise, and could be the man who can be relied upon to fight for Americans.
Among some of today's headliners are Donald Trump's children. A couple of them will be speaking tonight. Some are saying that Donald Trump's children are his best attributes. So what is the atmosphere there looking forward to these speeches tonight?
Yes, certainly people are looking forward to hearing from Donald Trump's children, Tiffany and Donald Jr. You know, many say that for all his, you know, shortcomings, nobody can question the fact that Mr. Trump is a great father. His children are well taken care of. They work together. And so they say this is the greatest attribute, perhaps by presenting them there, by having a whole family spread out throughout this week. And we know that the daughter will be introducing him on Thursday. This hasn't been seen in many, many years, where a presidential candidate actually had his wife and all his children speaking at the convention.
That's my colleague, VOA Vincent McCorry, at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, South Africa is the epicenter of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, with nearly 7 million people living with the disease. KwaZulu-Natal province has been especially hard hit. In 2011, an innovative project was launched in the province to improve treatment and prevention. A report on the project has been released in conjunction with the International AIDS Conference in Durban. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, and the KwaZulu-Natal Health Department sponsor the project. MSF Deputy Head of Mission in South Africa, Julia Hill, says it's called Bending the Curves.
It's about bending the curves of the epidemic, so bringing down incidents or new infections of HIV and TB in the project area. So we work in a district called Utungulu, and in this district, there's incredibly high prevalence of HIV. So about 1 in 4 people aged 15 to 59 are HIV positive.
While KwaZulu-Natal is the country's HIV hotspot, within the province itself, there are particular problem groups.
Young women especially have a really increased chance of contracting HIV, and young people in general between the ages of 15 and 29 have particularly high risk of HIV infections. Every year, approximately 3% of the female population aged 15 to 29 gets infected with HIV in the area, which is 3 times higher than the infection rates among men of the same age group.
MSF conducted a survey in 2013 to determine if the project had any effect.
You know, while 1 in 4 people were HIV positive that were between the ages of 15 and 59, 75% of them actually are aware of their status. And among those that were eligible for treatment at the time, 75% of those were on treatment. So that amounted to about half of all the people that were living with HIV in the area that we could say were on treatment.
Hill says a successful HIV/AIDS program must contain a combination of strategies, what's called a cascade of care. This includes getting people on treatment, which makes them much less likely to transmit the virus. Also, antiretroviral drugs can be given to uninfected sexual partners to protect them from HIV. Protection also includes condoms and male circumcision. TB must also be addressed, because it's often a co-infection with HIV and can kill much more quickly than AIDS. The project searches for people who are HIV positive in KwaZulu-Natal. This is done by putting testing labs in vans or tents at community events or schools. Testing sites also are located at shopping malls and colleges. And people go door to door in rural areas and test people in their homes. Hill says lay counselors and community health workers are essential for the program to succeed. The MSF official says the aim is to reach the UN goal called 90-90-90.
So 90% of people living with HIV know their status, 90% of those are on treatment, and 90% of those are virally suppressed, meaning that the treatment is working and they're not going to transmit HIV.
The report quotes one health worker as saying, "Before the Bending of the Curves project, we used to bury people every Saturday. Now, people are alive." Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. In related news, a new study says 2.5 million people were infected with the AIDS virus last year, a figure that has not changed much in the past 10 years. The study was published in the Lancet HIV Journal. It says there was very slow decline in new infections between 2005 and 2015, less than 1%. That compares to a decline in new infections of 2.7% between 1997 and 2006. The study also says the number of people living with HIV has increased from nearly 28 million in 2000 to almost 39 million last year. And annual deaths from HIV/AIDS has declined from a peak of 1.8 million in 2005 to 1.2 million in 2015. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At the now concluded African Union Summit in Kigali, participants launched the African e-passport for the continent's leaders, who agreed to help the AU become more financially self-sufficient. They also postponed the election of a new chairperson. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has highlights from the 27th AU summit.
Perhaps the most notable action, or inaction, to come from the summit was that delegates did not elect a new chairperson. None of the three candidates contesting the position received the necessary two-thirds majority vote, so the elections have been postponed until January and will likely include new candidates. Alyssa Jobson is the advisor on African Union relations for the International Crisis Group.
I think there's been general consensus, and even among some of the member states themselves, that the three candidates were not the best that Africa had to offer. So, you know, we've got an opportunity now that gives the member states a chance to look and to find better candidates, someone who can guide the African Union at what is actually quite a crucial time for them in terms of peace and security.
In a step towards self-reliance, the AU agreed to levy taxes on certain imports in order to fund itself, since external donors supply much of its current annual budget of almost $500 million. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, through his spokesperson, noted what he called the innovative funding arrangements aimed at providing the AU, via the Peace Fund, with increased financial means to address the peace and security challenges facing the continent. J. Peter Pham, director of the Washington-based Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, says it's about time.
Whether this is actually achieved or not remains to be seen. Up to date, it's been rather embarrassing that for an emerging continent, Africa is extremely dependent upon outsiders to even fund its own governance mechanisms.
The African Union announced its support for a request made by IGAD Plus, the East African regional bloc that includes Rwanda, South Africa, Nigeria, and Algeria, for African troops to help UN peacekeepers in South Sudan. That country's peace is tenuously holding under a ceasefire announced last week after violence rocked the capital, Juba. That request, which now goes to the UN Security Council, includes a revised mandate asking for the deployment of a regional protection force. Jobson says this sends a strong message.
Which sends a sign to Juba that, you know, the continent is serious about this, and that, you know, that they do want to see the violence ended and a lasting resolution found.
South Sudan's president, Salva Kiir, has rejected the idea of additional foreign troops entering his country. Separately, the first African e-passports were issued to AU heads of state, permanent representatives of those states, and ministers of foreign affairs, aiming to ease restrictions on the movement of people, goods, and services across borders. And Morocco formally asked to rejoin the African Union. It left the Organization of African Unity, the AU's predecessor, in 1984 because the AU recognized the independence of Western Sahara. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A recent nationwide survey of public opinion in Tunisia by the International Republican Institute indicates persistent dissatisfaction with the economy. Experts say the survey reinforces the need for meaningful economic reforms and international economic aid. Amy Hawthorne is the Deputy Director of Research at Project for Middle East Democracy. VOA's Mohammed Elshenawi asked her what the U.S. and the European Union can do to help the Tunisian economy.
There's a variety of measures that the U.S. and Europe can take to help Tunisia economically. First is what we've already been doing a lot of, which is helping Tunisia with its immediate fiscal challenges. Tunisia's had to borrow a lot of money in order to make ends meet, and the U.S. and Europe have provided a number of measures to help Tunisia have access to financing at very favorable terms. The other thing that the U.S. and Europe can do together, and they can promote investment, they can promote tourism, they can show, and the U.S. can show, that we have confidence in Tunisia's long-term future, even though the times right now are rocky. So we can send signals of confidence and support to encourage private investors. The third thing that I think we can do is we can help Tunisia develop sort of the soft skills in its economy that it really needs to develop. And this is where the U.S., I believe, has a lot to offer in terms of helping small and medium businesses, helping entrepreneurship, helping improve education so that the Tunisian workforce will be very attractive and it'll become a desirable place for international investment and for Tunisian investors as well.
A plurality of 61% of Tunisians affirmed their satisfaction with transition to democracy in Tunisia. Does that mean Tunisia is heading in the right direction?
I personally believe that Tunisia is heading in the right direction. What I can see, looking at Tunisia in comparison to other democratic transitions, that Tunisia has a lot going for it. Many ingredients that bode well for its long-term success. It has a pretty homogenous population. It doesn't have sectarian or ethnic division. It has a relatively highly educated population. It has a history of relative stability, not civil wars and such in its past. So those are among the factors that...
But how would you compare it to the situation in Egypt after the Arab Spring?
Completely different situation. It's night and day. In Tunisia, The military has never had a significant political or economic role, and the military in Tunisia played an important role in guaranteeing a democratic transition without trying to seize power for itself. And so civilians immediately took over, and Tunisians have this, they take pride in what they consider their political culture of consensus and compromise. Indeed, staunch secularists and the formerly outlawed Islamist party have come together and agreed on a path forward. In every way, and when Tunisia and Egypt has been faced with a choice, Tunisia has made, in my opinion, a wise and mature political choice, and Egypt has made a poor choice.
In your testimony in a congressional hearing, you recommended a recalibration of U.S. policy toward Egypt. What does that entail?
The United States making very clear through various instruments that we have, through our massive military aid, our smaller economic aid program, our diplomatic engagement, and so forth with the Egyptian government, that we are very concerned about the path, the destructive path that Egypt is on. We can make it perfectly clear with the Egyptian government where we stand, and that we're very concerned that the mass repression in Egypt is only going to contribute to instability in the future.
That was Amy Hawthorne, the Deputy Director of Research at Project for Middle East Democracy. She spoke with reporter Mohammed Elshenawi. More than 2,500 migrants were rescued today on the Mediterranean after leaving Libya in overcrowded, unsafe vessels. Reuters reports that smugglers took advantage of the good weather and calm seas to launch 26 rafts and boats toward Europe. About 1,000 of the migrants have been brought safely to shore in Italy so far. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.